ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. Look, I know everyone's celebrating America's birthday, but at Late Night Live, we're celebrating in our own way, just as you would expect. With music, of course, but also by taking the occasion to ask a couple of fundamental questions. Later, what, if anything, did the rebellion of the colonies have to do with the price of tea in Boston? All I'll say at this point is bloody little. But first, what's the real link between them getting rid of Britain and Britain getting its hooks into us? Even before the North American colonies declared their independence, 250 years ago this week, they were refusing to take convicts from Britain. So for a dozen years, prisoners were housed in hulks at home in conditions that began even to disgust the British. Only when the American colonies were lost, and with them the last hope of dumping convicts once again across the Atlantic, was the decision taken, despite the immense distances involved, to ship convicts to Botany Bay. Hence Australia. Or that's what we were all taught when we were kids. But there's a new school of historians that reckons the links between the American Revolution and the colonisation of this country were actually the expression of a new and more ruthless brand of imperialism. As my guest historian Kate Fulliger argues, Australian colonisation was about far more than overcrowded jails. Kate Fulliger is Professor of History at the Australian Catholic University, Vice President of the Australian Historical Association, written lots of books. Her most recent is a venturesome, unique, joint biography of Bennelong and Philip. It's called Bennelong and Philip, A History Unravelled. Kate, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
Kate, what was the great lesson that Britain took from the loss of its American colonies?
In a nutshell, I would say that the lesson was never give an inch. But I should sort of contextualise that by saying that I think most historians for a very long time, perhaps it's still the dominant view, is that the great lesson that Britain learnt was to make sure that you don't crack down on colonists too hard, because then they might, you know, foment a revolution against you, so that you should, you know, instigate a more liberal empire.
Be a bit kinder.
That's right.
But
I would say that between 1780s and about 1830s, which we might say is the beginning of a more kind of liberal age, in that 50-year period, I believe that the main lesson was the reverse, actually. And you can sort of see that, I believe, mostly in the way that they approached New South Wales, or what they thought of as New Holland at the time. So the idea that they would just turn to New South Wales because they suddenly had a convict dumping problem. First, I mean, it is a very popular theory. It is still taught to school kids. I think that's what most people would think. And the leading reason really is because the documentary evidence says this. You can find official documents saying we'll need to go to New South Wales to solve our convict problem. But there are actually a lot of other political and economic things going on in other types of papers that are about the foundation of New South Wales. And primarily, I think that they're pushed there because they want to think about a new imperial centre, knowing that they've lost the Atlantic centre. And if they're going to make a new imperial centre somewhere in what we might call today the global south, then one of the greatest lessons that they took was that we're not going to create a set of colonies, a bunch of kind of settler colonists who might one day feel free enough or emboldened enough to turn against us. So started out quite well by using unfree labour as the vanguard.
The convicts.
That's right, the convicts. But then also instituting a much more centralised type of economy and politics, being increasingly ruthless towards convicts, not lessening their ruthlessness, and actually, as you see in those initial decades, also an increasing kind of dismissal of the Indigenous people who were there. So I think that you can track over those sort of 50-year period, this sort of often a lost period, the 1780s to 1830s, increasing disciplinary kind of attitude.
One of the points you make, which I think is terrific, is that the cost of sending a convict all the way over the world to Botany Bay was huge. If you just wanted to dump convicts, you could do it on the coast of Africa somewhere.
That's right. I mean, the Treasury knew this because certain historians long before me, Alan Frost particularly, had kind of calculated that from the Treasury records you could see that sending a convict all the way over to New South Wales is roughly three times the price that you'd pay just to keep them in hulks nearby in Britain. So there are other reasons to, I mean, there's a recognition that there's an oversupply of convicts and it is sort of a managerial problem, but they are also kind of instrumentalised to fit another political problem, which was how are we going to kind of shift the axis of our empire?
A question you may be outside your field, but why not Canada?
That is a really good question. There are, when you sort of start thinking, well, if it's just a convict problem, you have stable colonies in Canada, you still have stable colonies in the Caribbean. And then people did, for several years in the early 1780s, debate various ports along West Africa. So I think that the North, the Northern Hemisphere is kind of ruled out because they do have their sights set on having a new kind of centre somewhere in the Southern Hemisphere, partly because they just need to kind of give up the idea of Atlantic domination. They see that the rising US is there, possibly becoming not just kind of like the opposite of them, but actually a rival imperial power, which turned out to be true. But they've still got their eyes on, you know, traditional old European rivals like France, and they know also that France is scouting for a new type of imperial centre. They know that they're probably also thinking about the South Pacific, and that is a galvanising force to think, actually, maybe not the southern part of Africa, but maybe the southern part of the Pacific.
La Pérouse was sailing the Pacific. And at that stage, of course, the revolution, the French Revolution, had not begun.
That's right, yes, so 1788. So I think that when Philip realises that La Pérouse has, you know, arrived on Botany Bay just some weeks after he has, nowadays, because that never came to anything, I think it's that there's an easy temptation to think, oh, well, of course, it was never going to be a threat. But I think Arthur Philip thought it could well have been a threat because French rivalry is everything that he knew about how British colonisation worked in North America. So he knew, oh, here they are again. We have the same, you know, problem of British or French kind of supremacy. Little did he know, though, that 1 year later, France was totally out of the running because they had to deal with an unprecedented type of revolution.
Let's go back for a moment to before the uprising of the colonies in America. You write that at that time there was a more liberal, decent discourse going in Britain about the way in which it conducted its empires and the way in which the empire in India and the Pacific should be conducted.
Yes.
But that debate just stops dead.
Yes. Yes. So, I mean, you use the word sort of a more liberal idea about empires. I suppose liberalism I associate so much with modernity in the 19th century and onwards. But what I would say is that, you know, earlier in the 18th century, there is a much more genuine type of discussion in the public sphere about whether endless expansion is good for Britain. So it's not always about, you know, tinged with a humanitarian kind of view about Indigenous people that are being colonised, but a lot of people mounting the argument that expansion will lead you down the road of ancient Rome, you know, into decadence and fall. A lot of people think that it is going to make you hypocritical if you start talking too much about freeborn rights of people. So there's lots of debate about whether expansion is a good idea around about the time, I would say, of 1717, 1780s, as they're kind of suffering through the American Revolution. That critique lessens a lot. And if there's any debate about empire, it's really about what kind of empire they want, whether they should be there at all.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Kate Fulliger about the links between the American Revolution and the settlement, the colonial settlement of Australia. Kate, There was, you write, a kind of immediate focus after the loss of the American colonies on India and making India more of a traditional colony, less of a commercial company run.
That's right, settlement.
But more of a traditional settlement. And while this was promoted to the Indians as being sort of a civilized way of doing things, yes. You argue that it was not.
No, so I think that's probably still controversial, I think, amongst historians of British India, and I don't count myself as one of them. But I think that you can see, and I don't think that there's a British imperial kind of desire to make the East India Company kind of run presence in India more like a traditional crown colony. I don't think they wanted it, but they were frustrated that the company itself seemed inefficient, seemed to always require extra financial help from the government. And then increasingly through a series of acts through 1780s, through 1790s, you see that the British government gradually take over more and more responsibility of the company because they don't want it to lose, I guess, the control of British kind of supremacy there against, again the French rather than, you know, Indian rivals. And so those acts increasingly give the government more and more power until about 1850s when they just say, you know, let's stop the pretense of a company. We're actually going to take it over as a crown colony.
This is a colony, yes. Yeah. And they were exploring the Pacific before the decision was taken to settle at Botany Bay. They were exploring the Pacific for what? Were they looking for bases? Were they looking for commerce? What was the purpose of all of that back and forth?
I think it's debated quite a lot by historians. I think that a lot of historians who are particularly inspired by the Cook voyages especially, and they are, you know, quite fascinating for any kind of reader, but they are inspired to think, along with what you can read in those voyage literature, that it's about scientific discovery, that it's an embodiment of an Enlightenment intellectual enterprise. And it probably was as well, to be honest. But I think it's undeniable that from the 1760s and 1770s, people in Britain are already realising that geopolitics is changing, that France is not going to just give up its contest with British supremacy just because they kind of lost certain bits in the Americas in the 1760s, that they have to keep on thinking about fresh new worlds. And so when you read the journal, say, of Joseph Banks and James Cook, with that in mind, it becomes the certain phrases kind of leap out at you much more readily, which is, you know, how carefully they're denoting the capacity of the soils, how many Indigenous people actually are in this site, you know, what kind of attitudes might they have to newcomers from settling. You can start seeing, you know, a much different kind of political and economic agenda in the way that they write about what they could see in the South Pacific.
And then eventually the ships with their convict load, only 700. I thought there were rather more. And only 700, of course. Yep. My lot were in the second fleet, you'd understand.
All right,
that.
Yes.
but they arrive in New South Wales.
Yes.
Hitherto, the British had seen how cheap and convenient it was to make treaties with the people whose land they were taking.
Yes.
But this does not seem to survive contact in Australia.
That's right.
Do you think it was always decided in Whitehall, before those ships set out for the new world of Australia, that we were just gonna occupy this place? Or was it something that was a decision made further down the track?
I absolutely think it was a decision made further down the track. I think Australian historians like to face the conundrum of why no treaty in this country by kind of gesturing to a kind of an assumption that, of course, the British don't make treaties because look at their imperial history. Of course, they were going to come to Australia and ride roughshod. In the end, of course, in hindsight, we knew that it kind of did pan out a little bit like that. But what I like to emphasise is that is brand new in British history. That is unprecedented for British officials to have done that, to have not had some kind of either official conquest, official purchase, or some kind of agreement. And I will hasten to say that a lot of those agreements that occurred in North America and South Asia were, you know, dodgy.
Desperately unfair.
Desperately unfair, completely dodgy. but they existed. And so the fact that it never existed in New South Wales is historically very, very interesting. It's rare, and I don't think Australians quite fully appreciate how odd it is, and I think that they'd profit by thinking about the oddity of it. So with that in mind, I kind of particularly looked at Arthur Phillip's kind of motivations or thought thinking about this, because he's the one who was going to obviously officiate if there was going to be a treaty. And I'd argue that he, who was a veteran of North America, had seen how British colonisation worked there. He well assumed that a treaty would be forthcoming. I think it hugely explains his determination to keep up a relationship with Bennelong, why he wants to bring Bennelong over to Britain.
And clothe him beautifully.
Clothe him beautifully. There's only one particular kind of audience that would be deserving of the extraordinary apparel that Bennelong was given, far fancier than anything Arthur Phillip ever wore, was to see the king. Because Phillip knew that there'd been a huge tradition all the way back through the 18th century that that's what you did. You had Indigenous people come over to secure or confirm a treaty. And probably also, yes, those officials even themselves knew that they were dodgy treaties. But what I'm interested in is that they existed.
And that you gave them a tour of London.
Yes, and always generally the same tour as
yes.
well. Yes,
St. Paul's Cathedral,
yes,
the Greenwich Docks.
Yes, so you see military power, you see political power, you see religious power. You know, these are not accidental sites that are kind of given to these Indigenous people. A conviction that they have allied with the right power is
and Bennelong was given the tour but never met the king.
That's right. So Phillip set him on exactly the same itinerary as former Pacific Islanders had been set on, and before that Cherokee or Iroquois and a whole bunch of other envoys that had come through the 1700s. I think it's that Phillip, you know, had no way of knowing that actually in this time King George III was not going to meet with Bennelong.
Because the mood had changed.
The mood had changed. So by 1793-4, when Bennelong is there, you know, geopolitics really had become apparent to Whitehall that they were different. The French were absolutely not going to be a contestant in this new place where Bennelong came from. They had already realised that the British had, I mean, a lot of people like Phillip knew this to a grievous extent, that they had brought in smallpox, which had done a heck of a lot of the removal that they wanted eventually to occur. They just knew that demographically they were never going to have to face the numbers that they would have had to face in North America. So the idea of, you know, treating because you had to demographically, or you had to because there was a rival European power, were just not there. And so together with a much more hardline view about empire, which is what I talked about, how the repercussion of having to fight these disloyal colonists, those three things together, I think, create this unprecedented situation where they think, now, actually, we don't have to treat.
On Late Night Live, this is David Marr talking to Kate Fulliger about the links between the American Revolution and the settlement, the white settlement of Australia. So, Kate, you would draw a line carefully as a historian between the British response to losing the North American colonies and the peculiar cruelty, really, of the settlement of New South Wales.
I would. And, of course, you know, a lot of people have always drawn that line because they think it's about convicts. They think, oh, we lost the place where we normally dump convicts and now we've got a new place to dump convicts. So the line is still there, but I don't think it's about convicts. I think it's about politics. I think it's about European rivalry. I think it's about desperately setting new sites for continued expansion. You know, when you lose an Atlantic empire, it's the option of retracting no longer seemed to be on the table. We have to keep expanding. The last region to turn their eyes to was the South Pacific.
Did the settlement of Australia fulfil the hopes of Britain? Now, that's a huge question.
That's a very big question. Well, I must say, as a committed 18th century historian, I generally start losing interest from about 1800 onwards. But I think that it's
strange tastes, ladies and gentlemen, strange tastes.
I think it's fair to say that there is some absence of mind after the fleets that are first established, in terms of, you know, carefully administering what's going on in the colony. I think there is just a bit of trust that it's just going to manage itself, chiefly because the British are then mired in 23 years of fighting the French Revolution, so that kind of their motivations are, you know, switched around a bit. But But I think that by the time they get into the 1820s and 1830s and they start seeing actually new resources come in from this new settler colony or settler colonies that are now reproducing, they see that it actually turns into quite a good base for other types of Pacific trades like whaling. They think, yes, actually this is panning out to be politically and economically useful. The discussion has well gone beyond thinking about what to do with the penal system.
Yes, an imperial strategy. Yeah. Kate, there was another difference between the settlement of Australia and the settlement of particularly North America. In North America, the British set aside huge tracts of land for the Indian people, for the First Nations peoples,
yes,
of North America.
Yes.
In Australia, not an acre was set aside for the Indigenous people.
That's right.
Do you think there's some link between those two?
Yes. Well, protection of Indigenous lands, as it was called in North America, is part of the treaty, right? That is written into the treaties that, it's not just about, handing over goods for land, that's handing over often conditions. And protection, drawing a line, and it's actually often called the protection line, running down the Appalachians, was part of the agreement. And what they saw, and I think this is still contested, it'd be interesting to see how much this comes up in the next week amongst historians in North America, but what I think they saw was that it was the actual protection line that aggravated settlers in America so much that that's why they sparked a rebellion against the British Parliament. It's, the idea that you could, that it's about
tea.
Democratic ideas of, yes, or of freedom to tea and not pay tax on a tea, or ideas about a free people, I think very much come secondary to the outrage of a British government telling them where they can and cannot settle. And so that, I think that is brought over to their new start in New South Wales and thinking, well, we won't get into trouble again like that by aggravating these settler colonists. We will not have that as a problem that they will, rebel against us with, together with a much more disciplinary kind of centralised and controlled society altogether anyway.
Yes, we're going to take up the protection line on the show this week as well.
Oh, good.
Yes. The New South Wales, as it emerged, was quite cheap to run, was it not? Now, I know that this is getting slightly out of your area.
Yes.
But the original fears that the whole thing would be a huge drain on the exchequer turned out not to be true, because it was quite profitable to be out here. Was there also a notion after the American Revolution, a sort of a contrary notion really, that you didn't need many troops in a colony? Because there were very few British troops
here
in New South Wales.
Yes.
Very few.
Well, having an open prison where kind of nowhere to go, I guess it does lessen the need for actual military presence, despite the rather disciplinary nature of it all. I think that, it's made very clear to Philip that he has to make this colony self-sustaining as quickly as possible. That doesn't actually occur for some time, but there is a very strict kind of impression made from the beginning that it has to be self-sustaining. And you can see Philip's recognition of that, I think, in several of the letters that he writes back to Evan Nepean, the naval board, anyone who's going to be taking up his letters, where he says, please send me the skilled convicts. Don't send me the ragamuffins. Send me the carpenters. Send me the bakers. Send me the people who can actually build the society if you want me to make it self-sufficient.
And that plea was to continue for something like 80 years.
That's right, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, I mean, I'm not going to go into the wars about the demographics of your average convict, but it is increasingly noticeable that the convicts that do that are sent are the ones that are much more highly skilled and the ones that are selected out to help make this a self-sustaining idea.
A third possible connection between the American Revolution and the colonisation of Australia, time. It must have happened eventually, but did the American Revolution mean it happened when it did?
Well, yes, the timing is very interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think it is something about that by the 1770s and 1780s, endless expansion is on the agenda. As I tried to suggest beforehand, I think earlier in the 18th century, the very idea of expansion is up for debate. You know, that there is a worry that you could overextend yourself. I think that worry has kind of disappeared by the 1780s. So if you're going to endlessly expand, then you have to start looking elsewhere. If the Atlantic center is gone, so the South Pacific seems the most important. There's another thing that I've just recently been working on, which is actually the start of my new research project, which is that I argue that the actual trigger, once they've pretty much decided that New South Wales is going to be the base, the actual trigger to make them make the decision in 1786 to send Phillip particularly is a piece of intelligence that they received the year before that said the French Navy is rearming in Toulon at a much quicker pace than Britain realises it is. And Phillip is sent on two covert missions as a spy to confirm this intelligence. And he comes back and says it's true. The French Navy is much, much bigger than we... it's building ships at a much greater rate than we know. And that goes back to, again, Evan Nepean, who's sort of in charge of intelligence gathering and setting up the New South Wales colony. So he's kind of like the official at the centre of so many decisions. And he makes the assumption, oh, I think that's the French making a play for the South Pacific. So now we go.
And so that's a separate, completely separate source of urgency.
That's right. So I don't think it tells you about why they go to New South Wales, but I think it explains a little bit about why then, what the exact trigger is, you know, because they've been debating it for years through the early 1780s. So my next project is actually not so much about New South Wales, but I discovered that the person who sent that piece of intelligence from Toulon was a woman spymaster residing in Rotterdam. So my new project is about her.
Very good, very good. A last question. Do you think Australians of today should be grateful to the United States?
Oh, that's such a big question, isn't it? Well, I think there's lots of reasons politically and culturally that Australians can be interested in the United States. But yes, if you're a white settler, I think you can draw a direct line to what happened for the American Revolution. I think if you're an Indigenous Australian, you might have a completely different idea about the repercussions of that event.
Kate, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks so much, David.
I've been speaking to Kate Fulliger, historian, professor at the Australian Catholic University, author of scads of books, most recently Phillip and Bennelong. And we look forward, Kate, to the spy mistress of Rotterdam.
Thank you.
You will come on the show to discuss it, will you?
I will.
Good. See you then.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the real reason the colonists took up arms against the crown. The footprint of the 13 colonies that declared their independence 250 years ago this week was small. They hugged the coast from Massachusetts down to Georgia, but ran inland no further than the Appalachian Mountains. For the British had guaranteed all the country, from the mountains to the Mississippi, those enormous territories, would stay in Native American hands. We've been brought up on the fable that the colonies rebelled for idealistic reasons, no taxation without representation. But my guest this morning, Professor Colin Calloway of Dartmouth College, argues that while high principles mattered, what began the march to independence was hunger for that forbidden Indian land. Washington, he writes, spent a lifetime turning Indian homelands into real estate for himself and the nation. Colin Calloway is the John Kimball Jr. Professor of History and Native American and Indigenous Studies at Dartmouth College. A few years ago, he wrote a book that upended traditional histories of the Revolution, The Indian World of George Washington, published by Oxford University Press. Colin, welcome.
Thank you, David. Very nice to be talking with you.
Does it boil down to this? For America to go west, Britain had to go.
That's a very succinct way of putting it, but essentially, yes. I think for somebody like George Washington and many others of the colonial elite, they had staked their future on Britain defeating France and thereby removing their main European competitor in North America and the main ally of Indian nations who were fighting to defend their land. And the expectation was, and the purpose of investing in these Western lands was, that once the French were defeated, Native people would be left without allies and powerless, and colonists would sweep over the mountains, and those people who had investments, who had speculated in those lands, would essentially clean up. And in 1763 proclamation, the British, as you said in your introduction, said, well, no, because while Britain claims all of that territory, the lands west of the mountains will be an Indian reserve. And that doesn't mean we'll never take that land. But what it does mean is that the only people who will take that land, who can buy and sell that land essentially, are the duly appointed agents of the Crown, i.e. not George Washington, not Patrick Henry, not all these people who got these claims. And once that realization hits home, then I think people like George Washington, who'd fought for the British Empire in the Seven Years' War, realize we got rid of France, and you know, as you said, now we have to get rid of Britain. France closed the door to those Western lands, and now Britain is doing the same thing. And I think that's part of the equation in this country. No taxation without representation, as you rightly say. Everybody knows that. But there's another piece of it, and that is protecting Indian land. And even the taxation without representation is complicated, because one of the reasons why the Brits need to tax the colonists is because they are have decided they need to keep an army in America. And the cost of keeping 10,000 men in North America is huge. So who are we going to get to pay for that? Not British people, British in England, who are taxed to the hilt, but American colonists whom we're trying to protect in the first place. So it's all, from my perspective, it all revolves around Native Americans and Native American land.
This history is unfamiliar to most Australians, the history of sort of foreign ownership of North America. Why were the French there? Why did the British get rid of them?
So if we look at North America, this is part of colonial history writ large. Right? European nations laying claim to other territories, indeed to other continents. It's like a huge board game in which people are claiming territories that they don't actually possess and occupy. They're agreeing to pass those territories to other powers. It's often based on the doctrine of discovery. That is, the first Christian nation there who claims it has the first claim to it, and that claim can be transferred to another nation, etc. The contest for North America, I mean, Spain was there, France was there, Britain was there. Previously, you'd had the Swedes, you had Russia, etc. But by the 18th century, the two major contestants for hegemony in North America were Britain and France, the two superpowers of Europe. And the French were in New France, or what we'd essentially call Canada, but Canada linked to the Ohio River and the Mississippi, because European penetration of North America follows these major waterways. And the French Empire is based essentially on the fur trade. And the fur trade required, not in the classic view of settler colonists eliminating native people. The fur trade required native people as customers, as hunters. And so the French built networks of alliances with native people, often intermarried with native people. And that was the basis of French power in North America. The British, on the other hand, they were focused on acquiring land, and British migration to the American colonies was largely of families, right? And families that viewed independence in terms of economic independence, which meant land. It actually was, in many cases, making sure there was enough land for you and the next generation and the next generation, right? And so it seemed as if America had lots of land, and Britain and, you know, other parts of Europe were overcrowded with very little land. But for Britain to edge westward, right, that would take it into the Ohio Valley. And the French viewed that as a real threat because the Ohio River represented the major artery into the heart of the continent. Yes. So when the French see traders from Pennsylvania, settlers from Virginia, people seeping into the Ohio country, the French respond by building garrisons. And the British respond by, well, we've got to get rid of those garrisons. And you get this kind of Cold War becomes a hot war, waged in Indian country and in which Indian people very often play a pivotal role. But it's, you have these two empires on a collision course. And by the middle of the 18th century, it's apparent to both of them that really that they cannot coexist. And for the British to defeat the French as they do, it's not just more troops, more armaments. The Brits have to learn to seduce, in the 18th century sense of the term, Indian allies from the French, because the Indian people are not fighting as pawns of the French. They're not fighting for French goals. They're fighting for native goals. And native goals are protect your land, protect your independence, protect your way of life. And so the British learn that in order to win the native peoples, native nations away from the French, they have to be clear in a commitment to say, your lands will be safe. Right, your sovereignty will be respected.
So that's the 1863 treaty.
And 1763.
I'm sorry, 1763 yeah. treaty. And it's only a dozen years later that the Declaration of Independence is being made. The Declaration of Independence itself hints at this ambition for land.
Yeah.
One of the complaints against the king is the difficulty of appropriating land.
Yes. 1763, church bells are ringing, and this is a huge celebration. And as you said, a mere 12 years later, everything's beginning to fall apart. Because, well, all kinds of reasons, but one is there's no longer the French threat. The colonists can question what's going on, and their expectation is that movement into Western land will be uninhibited. And of course, one of the things that happens is Americans, you know, colonial governments and the people become leaders of the state, refer unabashedly to, we will go west and take the land. But they usually call it west, they either call it land or Western land, or later on after the United States is established, public land. But they very rarely call it Indian land. Right? And that kind of goes to the heart of the problem, and that is that there's kind of an assumption that the land is there for the taking. Washington never blinks at the idea that, you know, for him, he says, if we don't expand beyond the Appalachians, we'll be a nothing country. We have to expand and occupy that land. We have to build this nation on Western land. Well, of course, what he's talking about is Indian land, indigenous land.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Professor Colin Calloway who is the author of The Indian World of George Washington and an authority in the United States about the role of Native American history in the creation of a new nation. So when the fighting began, the British were supported in many ways by the Indians, weren't they?
Yeah. And often what happened at the beginning of the war is that a lot of Native people are confused. Why are the British people fighting each other? A lot of them smartly think, well, we'd better stay out of it. It's like a domestic quarrel. Who wants to get in the middle of that?
Yes.
So we'd like to stay out of it. But this is a war that really allows no neutrals. And I think for many Native people, not all of them, Indian peoples in New England, Indian peoples in Nova Scotia, you know, Oneida people in New York, support the Americans. But for a lot of Native people, if this is a choice between the British government that at least made some attempt to protect our homelands and the Americans who've made it clear that this war of independence is also a war about access to Indian land, then our best interests and our self-interests require us to side with the British. We can make common cause with the British. It's not because they have any special love of the British. I mean, they know what's going on. But they see in the British potential bulwark and allegiance against these aggressive American colonists, this aggressive new nation that is essentially predicated on taking Indian land.
But Washington was at the same time, was he not, making promises to the Indians that he too would protect their lands.
Yeah, and one of the ironic things I found out when I was writing the book, when Britain issued the Royal Proclamation, which basically said, well, it's had a number of things, but it's basically saying only the central government can control the sales of Indian land. Washington, I mean, he went nuts. He went apoplectic, right? In 1790, Washington's president, and the United States does much the same thing in the passing the Indian Trade and Intercourse Act, which said that no sales of Indian land, transfers of Indian land, are legal unless approved by Congress. Right? And what's happened is, of course, that Washington has inherited the same problem. How do you, as the colonial government, the central government, the imperial government, I would call it what you want, control things on the frontier? When you recognize that the major trigger to violence on the frontier is settler aggression and invasion and trespass onto Indian land, how do you stop that? Right? Well, you can make an effort in the capital, but how do you enforce that out on the frontier? Because the people that you're trying to control are not going to be controlled. Well, one of the things that you do then is you make treaties and agreements with Native people. You promise to protect them. Your citizens and settlers encroach, trespass onto their land. Violence flares up, and then you have no choice but to send in the troops and protect your own citizens, defeat Native people, make another treaty, draw another boundary, and the whole thing starts over again. Now, I don't believe that Washington is so cynical, but he does say it would take a Chinese wall to protect Indian land against our citizen. I also think that, and this surprised me because I was never particularly a fan of George Washington when I started writing this book.
But there's some admiration there, yes.
Yeah. Especially in later, not as a young man, I think he's a twit, but in later life, I think he actually does wrestle with this dilemma. How can we build a nation on Indian land, which is actually what he's doing, and he says as much. I've been saying that a lot. And these days, people say, what do you mean? But Washington said that. That was ingrained. But he also wanted and struggled for ways to achieve taking Indian land and dealing fairly and honorably with Indian people. And that's very much a have your cake and eat it too situation. And it's not a complete dilemma because these are not equal commitments, right? There's no question.
No.
We're going to take Indian land, but we're a new nation. We want to look good to the world. We want to look good to our own citizens. We want to look good to posterity. And to do that, we need to show that we're different from Spain, for instance, in the way that Henry Knox, his Secretary of War, put it.
Better than Spain.
Yeah, because they had this horrible reputation for carnage and genocide. And so they do wrestle with it.
Successfully?
No. But I think I would say enough for me to say that I don't think it's hypocrisy. I think they are struggling with it. But they've got a tiger by the tail, and at the same time, they're also riding the tiger.
Right? Yes.
You can outsource the dirty work of empire building to the people on the frontier, protest that this was never supposed to happen, but at the same time, this was the intent all along, just without the bloodshed, right?
Yes.
And so I think one of the things that happens, well, you've got a handful of options, I guess. If you're going to take native land, you can do it. Try the British model. Try making treaties. That's the best way they can think of to deal fairly and honorably. Offer native people a fair price from their land. The problem kicks in when native people say, well, thanks very much, but we don't want to sell you our land.
Yes, then yes.
Washington starts referring to them as recalcitrant savages and they have to be crushed. Well, that's one thing if you've got the force to do that. And in 1791, Washington dispatches an army into the Ohio country to destroy this Indian resistance movement. And what happens is the American army is destroyed. I mean, not just defeated, it's obliterated, and it's the only army the United States has at the time. This is 1791. The country's like 15 minutes old.
And the Indians destroy their military forces.
Indians destroy it, totally. With Britain still in the north, Spain still in the south. And so going to war to defeat Indians, certainly in battle, is a precarious option. And what evolves out of all of these conversations, I think, Washington, Henry Knox, led Thomas Jefferson, is what seems like a convoluted recipe, but it is basically this, that Indians have too much land. And as long as they have so much land, Indian men will continue to be hunters. Right? They knew that Native peoples east of the Mississippi, almost everywhere, were farmers. There were cornfields, hundreds and thousands of acres of cornfields. Washington sent armies to destroy them during the American Revolution. But what they wanted to do was make Indian men into farmers, and so that women could do properly domestic chores. And for 18th, 19th century America, the markers of civilization, of course, were agriculture.
Yes.
And Christianity and those kinds of things.
Colin, I can't tell you how familiar so much of this is to Australians,
yes,
looking at their own history, except for two real differences, which I find fascinating. One is we never tried treaties in this country. This was, Australia was settled without any notions of treaties. The other is this, that America has managed to romanticize the process into the Western genre. And we've never romanticized it in Australia.
Yes. All my life, certainly since I've been living here, which is, 40 years or so, I've been trying to understand this country. And I can only understand the history of this country by including Native Americans, because without it, without Native Americans, this it doesn't make any sense to me. So you have to have Native people in American history to understand American history. But once you start doing that, and all of my books in some way do that, George Washington was one manifestation of that. How do I show that Native Americans are essential to the history of the United States? Well, show that Native Americans were essential, fundamental in the life of the most important American, right? But once you start doing that, to get at it, you have to peel back these layers of history, mythology, romanticization, before you begin to expose the, you know, the underbelly. And especially these days, doing that is very unpopular in some circles. So that, you know, instead of just being a historian that everybody yawns at and ignores, which is something I've been used to for, you know, half a century, now I've got a target on my back, you know, because we're in attempting to give a more complicated, more inclusive, and in many ways much less positive view of history. You know, it's portrayed as unpatriotic because the Western movement has become such a part of American identity and who we are as a people and how the West was won and how pioneers with a rifle in one hand and a Bible in the other carved a new society out of the wilderness, etc. And those things are part of the history, but left alone, that's kind of getting close to a fairy tale. They're doing this on native land, and many of these people are themselves victims of this movement at the hands of land speculators, railroad companies, etc. It's just a much more sordid process than that romanticized version. I often said in my classes, history is not about feeling good or feeling guilty about the past. It's about trying to understand what people back then, why people back then did what they did, because we would probably have done the same thing in their situation. I'm fond of saying history is not the same thing as the past. It's the stories that we tell about the past. So who gets to decide which stories get told?
Well, and exactly.
Now, on the 250th, right? If you tell stories that are anything other than triumphant celebration, then you risk being dubbed an American or unpatriotic. But I'd argue that it should be a patriotic duty to actually look at the nation's history full on, own it, acknowledge it, recognize its failings, recognize that the people who founded the country dealt in half-truths as well as self-evident truths. And then you've got a much better embrace of a history that's actually much more representative and help a much better explains how things came to be the way they are.
Colin, thank you.
Thank you.
Colin Calloway is the John Kimball Jr. Professor of History and Native American and Indigenous Studies at Dartmouth College, author of The Indian World of George Washington, and an authority in the United States about the role of Native American history in the creation of a new nation. This is Late Night Live. Happy birthday, America. And that's the show and the week. Oh, and good luck to the Socceroos. It's fascinating game. But and my thanks, as always, to the Late Night team, producers Anne Arnold, Ali Benton and Catherine Zengerer, and our executive producer, Jack Schmidt. Until next week.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.